Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. In the Forest of Villa Fair by Robert E. Howard. The sun had set. The great shadows came striding over the forest. In the weird twilight of a late summer day, I saw the path ahead glide on among the mighty trees and disappear, and I shuddered and glanced fearfully over my shoulder. Miles behind lay the nearest village, miles ahead the next. I looked to left and to right as I strode on, and anon I looked behind me, and anon I stopped short, grasping my rapier as a breaking twig betokened the going of some small beast, or was it a beast? But the path led on, and I followed, because, forsooth, I had not else to do. As I went, I bethought me, my own thoughts will rout me, if I be not aware. What is there in this forest, except perhaps the creatures that roam it, deer and the like? Tush, the foolish legends of those villagers. And so I went, and the twilight faded into dusk. Stars began to blink, and the leaves of the trees murmured in the faint breeze. And then I stopped short, my sword leaping to my hand, for just ahead, around the curve of the path, someone was singing. The words I could not distinguish, but the accent was strange, almost barbaric. I stepped behind a great tree, and the cold sweat beaded my forehead. Then the singer came in sight, a tall, thin man, vague in the twilight. I shrugged my shoulders. A man I did not fear. I sprang out, my point raised. Stand. He showed no surprise. I prithee, handle thy blade with care, friend, he said. Somewhat ashamed, I lowered my sword. I am new to this forest, I quoth apologetically. I heard talk of bandits. I crave pardon. Where lies the road to Villa Fair? Corbleu, you've missed it, he answered. You should have branched off to the right some distance back. I am going there myself. If you abide my company, I will direct you. I hesitated. Yet, why should I hesitate? But certainly my name is Montour of Normandy. And I am Carolus de Loup. No, I started back. He looked at me in astonishment. Pardon, said I, the name is strange. Does not Loup mean wolf? My family were always great hunters, he answered. He did not offer his hand. You will pardon my staring, said I as we walked down the path, but I can hardly see your face in the dusk. I sensed that he was laughing, though he made no sound. It is little to look upon, he answered. I stepped closer and then leaped away, my hair bristling. A mask, I exclaimed. Why do you wear a mask, monsieur? It is a vow, he explained. And fleeing a pack of hounds, I vowed that if I escaped, I would wear a mask for a certain time. Hounds, monsieur? Wolves, he answered quickly. I said, wolves. We walked in silence for a while, and then my companion said, I am surprised that you walk these woods by night. Few people come these ways, even in the day. I am in haste to reach the border, I answered. A treaty has been signed with the English, and the Duke of Burgundy should know of it. The people at the village sought to dissuade me. They spoke of a wolf that was purported to roam these woods. Here the path branches to Villa Fair, he said, he, and I saw a narrow, crooked path that I had not seen when I passed it before. It led in amid the darkness of the trees. I shuddered. You wish to return to the village? No, I exclaimed. No, no, lead on. So narrow was the path that we walked single file, he leading. I looked well at him. He was taller, much taller than I, and thin, wiry. He was dressed in a costume that smacked of Spain. A long rapier swung at his hip. He walked with long, easy strides, noiselessly. Then he began to talk of travel and adventure. He spoke of many lands and seas he had seen and many strange things. So we talked and went further and further into the forest. I presumed that he was French, and yet he had a very strange accent that was neither French nor Spanish nor English, not like any language I had ever heard. Some words he slurred strangely, and some he could not pronounce at all. This path is not often used, is it? I asked. Not by men, he answered, and laughed silently. I shuddered. It was very dark, and the leaves whispered together among the branches. A fiend haunts this forest, I said. So the peasants say, he answered, but I have roamed it oft, and have never seen his face. Then he began to speak of strange creatures, of darkness, and the moon rose, and shadows glided among the trees. He looked up at the moon. Haste, said he, we must reach our destination before the moon reaches her zenith. We hurried along the trail. They say, said I, that a werewolf haunts these woodlands. It might be, said he, and we argued much upon the subject. The old women say, said he, that if a werewolf is slain while a wolf, then he is slain. But if he is slain as a man, then his half-soul will haunt his slayer forever. But haste thee, the moon nears her zenith. We came into a small moonlit glade, and the stranger stopped. Let us pause a while, said he. Nay, let us be gone, I urge. I like not this place. He laughed without sighing. Why, said he, this is a fair glade. As good as a banquet hall it is, and many times have I feasted here. Ha, look, ye, I will show you a dance. And he began, bounding here and there, anon flinging back his head, and laughing silently. Thought I, the man is mad. As he danced his weird dance, I looked about me. The trail went not on, but stopped in the glade. Come, said I, we must go on. Do you not smell the rank, hairy scent that hovers about the glade? Wolves then here, perhaps they are about us and are gliding upon us even now. He dropped upon all fours, bounded higher than my head, and came toward me with a strange slinking motion. That dance is called the Dance of the Wolf, said he, and my hair bristled. Keep off, I stepped back, and with a screech that set the echo shuddering, he leaped for me, and though a sword hung at his belt, he did not draw it. My rapier was half out when he grasped my arm and flung me headlong. I dragged him with me, and we struck the ground together. Wrenching a hand free, I jerked off the mask. A shriek of horror broke from my lips. Beast eyes glittered beneath that mask. White fangs flashed in the moonlight. The face was that of a wolf. In an instant, those fangs were at my throat. Taloned hands tore the sword from my grasp. I beat at that horrible face with my clenched fist, but his jaws were fastened on my shoulder. His talons tore at my throat. Then I was on my back. The world was fading. Blindly, I struck out. My hand dropped, then closed automatically about the hilt of my dagger, which I had been unable to get at. I drew and stabbed. A terrible half-bestial bellowing screech. Then I reeled to my feet, free. At my feet lay the werewolf. I stooped, raised the dagger, then paused, looked up. The moon hovered close to her zenith. If I slew the thing as a man, its frightful spirit would haunt me forever. I sat down waiting. The thing watched me with flaming wolf eyes. The long, wiry limbs seemed to shrink, to crook. Hair seemed to grow upon them. Fearing madness, I snatched up the thing's own sword and hacked it to pieces. Then I flung the sword away and fled. Wolf's Head by Robert E. Howard. Fear? Your pardon, messieurs, but the meaning of fear you do not know. No. I hold to my statement. You are soldiers, adventurers. You have known the charges of regiments of dragoons, the frenzy of windlashed seas. But fear, real, hair-raising, horror-crawling fear, you have not known. I myself have known such fear. But until the legions of darkness swirl from hell's gate and the world flames to ruin, will never such fear again be known to men. Hark, I will tell you the tale, for it was many years ago and half across the world. And none of you will ever see the man of whom I tell you, or seeing, no. Return, then, with me across the years to a day when I, a reckless young cavalier, stepped from the small boat that had landed me from the ship floating in the harbor, cursed the mud that littered the crude wharf, and strode up the landing toward the castle, in answer to the invitation of an old friend, Don Vicente d'Alusto. Don Vicente was a strange, fair-sighted man, a strong man, one who saw visions beyond the ken of his time. In his veins, perhaps, ran the blood of those old Phoenicians who, the priests tell us, ruled the seas and built cities in far lands. In the dim ages, his plan of fortune was strange and yet successful. Few men would have thought of it. Fewer could have succeeded, for his estate was upon the western coast of that dark, mystic continent, that baffler of explorers, Africa. There, by a small bay, had he cleared away the sullen jungle, built his castle and his storehouses, and with ruthless hand had he wrested the riches of the land. 4 ships he had, 3 smaller craft, and 1 great galleon. These plied between his domains and the cities of Spain, Portugal, France, and even England, laden with rare woods, ivory, the 1,000 strange riches that Don Vicente had gained by trade and by conquest. Aye, a wild venture, a wilder commerce. And yet might he have shaped an empire from the dark land, had it not been for the rat-faced Carlos, his nephew. But I run ahead of my tale. Look, messieurs, I draw a map on the table, thus, with finger dipped in wine. Here lay in the small, shallow harbor, and here the wide wharves. A landing ran thus, up the slight slope, with hut-like warehouses on each side, and here it stopped at a wide, shallow moat. Over it went a narrow drawbridge, and then one was confronted with a high palisade of logs set in the ground. This extended entirely around the castle. The castle itself was built on the model of another, earlier age, being more for strength than beauty, built of stone brought from a great distance. Years of labor and 1,000 men toiling beneath the lash had reared its walls, and now, completed, it offered an almost impregnable appearance. Such was the intention of its builders, for Barbary pirates ranged the coast, and the horror of an uprising lurked ever near. A space of about 0.5 mile on every side of the castle was kept cleared away, and roads had been built through the marshy land. All this had required an immense amount of labor, but manpower was plentiful. A present to a chief, and he furnished all that was needed, and Portuguese knew how to make men work. Less than 300 yards to the east of the castle ran a wide, shallow river, which emptied into the harbor. The name has entirely slipped my mind. It was a heathenish title, and I could never lay my tongue to it. I found that I was not the only friend invited to the castle. It seems that once a year, or some such matter, Don Vicente brought a host of jolly companions to his lonely estate and made merry for some weeks, to make up for the work and solitude of the rest of the year. In fact, it was nearly night, and a great banquet was in progress when I entered. I was acclaimed with great delight, greeted boisterously by friends, and introduced to such strangers as were there. Entirely too weary to take much part in the revelry, I ate, drank quietly, listened to the toasts and songs, and studied the feasters. Don Vicente, of course, I knew, as I had been intimate with him for years, also his pretty niece, Isabel, who was one reason I had accepted his invitation to come to that stinking wildness. Her second cousin, Carlos, I knew and disliked, a sly, mincing fellow with a face like a minx. Then there was my old friend, Luigi Varanza, an Italian, and his flirt of a sister, Marcita, making eyes at the men as usual. Then there was a short, stocky German who called himself Baron von Schiller, and Jean Desmart, and out-at-the-elbows nobleman of Gascony, and Don Florenzo de Seville, a lean, dark, silent man, who called himself a Spaniard and wore a rapier nearly as long as himself. There were others, men and women, but it was long ago, and all their names and faces I do not remember. But there was one man, whose face somehow drew my gaze as an alchemist's magnet draws steel. He was a leanly built man of slightly more than medium height, dressed plainly, almost austerely, and he wore a sword almost as long as a Spaniard's. But it was neither his clothes nor his sword which attracted my attention. It was his face, a refined, high-bred face. It was furrowed deep with lines that gave it a weary, haggard expression. Tiny scars flecked jaw and forehead, as if torn by savage claws. I could have sworn the narrow gray eyes had a fleeting, haunted look in their expression at times. I leaned over to that flirt Marcita, and asked the name of the man, as it had slipped my mind that we had been introduced. "De Montour, from Normandy," she answered. "A strange man. I don't think I like him." "Then he resists your snares, my little enchantress," I murmured, long friendship making me as immune from her anger as from her wiles. But she chose not to be angry, and answered coyly, glancing from under demurely lowered lashes. I watched De Montour much, feeling somehow a strange fascination. He ate lightly, drank much, seldom spoke, and then only to answer questions. Presently, toast making the rounds, I noticed his companions urging him to rise and give a health. At first he refused, then rose upon the repeated urgings, and stood silent for a moment, goblet raised. He seemed to dominate, to overawe the group of revelers. Then, with a mocking, savage laugh, he lifted the goblet above his head. To Solomon, he exclaimed, who bound all devils, and thrice cursed be he for that some escaped. A toast and a curse in one. It was drunk silently, and with many sidelong, doubting glances. That night I retired early, weary of the long sea voyage, and my head spinning from the strength of the wine of which Don Vicente kept such great stores. My room was near the top of the castle, and looked out towards the forest to the south and the river. The room was furnished in crude, barbaric splendor, as was all the rest of the castle. Going to the window, I gazed out at the arbutier, pacing the castle grounds, just inside the palisade, at the cleared space lying unsightly and barren in the moonlight, at the forest beyond, at the silent river. From the native quarters close to the river bank came the weird twanging of some rude lute, sounding a barbaric melody. In the dark shadows of the forest, some uncanny night bird lifted a mocking voice. A thousand minor notes sounded birds and beasts, and the devil knows what else. Some great jungle cat began a hair-lifting jowling. I shrugged my shoulders and turned from the windows. Surely devils lurked in those somber depths. There came a knock at my door, and I opened it to admit de Montour. He strode to the window and gazed at the moon, which rode resplendent and glorious. "The moon is almost full, is it not, monsieur?" he remarked, turning to me. I nodded, and I could have sworn that he shuddered. "Your pardon, monsieur, I will not annoy you further." He turned to go, but the door turned and retraced his steps. "Monsieur," he almost whispered with a fierce intensity, "whatever you do, be sure you bar and bolt your door tonight." Then he was gone, leaving me to stare after him bewilderedly. I dozed off to sleep, the distant shouts of the revelers in my ears, and I was weary, perhaps because of it, I slept lightly. While I never really awoke until morning, sounds and noises seemed to drift to me through my veil of slumber, and once it seemed that something was trying and shoving against the bolted door. As is to be supposed, most of the guests were in a beastly humor the following day, and remained in their rooms most of the morning, or else straggled down late. Besides Don Vicente, there was really only three of the masculine members sober, de Montour, the Spaniard, de Seville, as he called himself, and myself. The Spaniard never touched wine, and though de Montour consumed incredible quantities of it, it never affected him in any way. The ladies greeted us most graciously. "So truth, signor," remarked that minx Marcita, giving me her hand with a gracious air that was like to make me snicker. "I am glad to see there are gentlemen among us who care more for our company than for the wine cup, for most of them are most surprisingly befuddled this morning." Then, with the most outrageous turning of her wondrous eyes, "Methinks someone was too drunk to be discreet last night, or not drunk enough. For unless my poor senses deceive me much, someone came fumbling at my door late in the night." "Ha!" I exclaimed in quick anger. "No, hush." She glanced about as if to see that we were alone. "Is it not strange that Signor de Montour, before he retired last night, instructed me to fasten my door firmly?" "Strange," I murmured, but did not tell her that he had told me the same thing. "And is it not strange, Pierre, that though Signor de Montour left the banquet hall even before you did, yet he has the appearance of one who has been up all night?" I shrugged. A woman's fancies are often strange. "Tonight," she said roguishly, "I will leave my door unbolted and see whom I catch." "You will not do such a thing." She showed her little teeth in a contemptuous smile and displayed a small wicked dagger. "Listen, imp. De Montour gave me the same warning he did you. Whatever he knew, whoever prowled the halls last night, the object was more apt murder than amorous adventure. Keep you your doors bolted. The Lady Isabel shares your room, does she not?" "Not she. And I sent my woman to the servants' quarters at night," she murmured, gazing mischievously at me from beneath drooping eyelids. "One would think you a girl of no character from your talk," I told her, with the frankness of youth and of long friendship. "Walk with care, young lady, else I tell your brother to spank you." And I walked away to pay my respects to Isabel. The Portuguese girl was the very opposite of Marcita, being a shy, modest young thing, not so beautiful as the Italian, but exquisitely pretty and an appealing, almost childish air. I once had thought, hi-ho, to be young and foolish. "Your pardon, messieurs," an old man's mind wanders. "It was of de Montour that I meant to tell you. De Montour and Don Vicente's mink-faced cousin. De Montour came up, and presently Don Vicente turned to us and said, "One of the woodcutters of the village was torn to pieces by a leopard, or some such beast, last night. A strong young man, and unmarried." "A leopard? Did they see it?" suddenly asked De Montour. And when Don Vicente said no, that it came and went in the night, De Montour lifted a trembling hand and drew it across his forehead, as if to brush away cold sweat. "Look you, Pierre," quoth Don Vicente, "I have here a servant who, wonder of wonders, desires to be your man, though the devil only knows why." He led up a slim, mere youth, whose main asset seemed a merry grin. It was not long before I learned why Gola, that was his name, wished to be my man, choosing me amongst all the rest. It was because of my hair. Like many dandies of that day, I wore it long and curled, the strands falling to my shoulders. As it happened, I was the only man of the party who so wore my hair, and Gola would sit and gaze at it in silent admiration for hours at a time, or until, growing nervous under his unblinking scrutiny, I would boot him forth. It was that night that a brooding animosity, hardly apparent between Baron von Schiller and Jean de Smart, broke out into a flame. As usual, woman was the cause. Marcita carried on a most outrageous flirtation with both of them. That was not wise. De Smart was a wild young fool. Von Schiller was a lustful beast. But when, messieurs, did women ever use wisdom? Their hate flamed to a murderous fury when the German sought to kiss Marcita. Swords were clashing in an instant, but before Don Vicente could thunder command to halt, Luigi was between the combatants and had beaten their swords down, hurling them back viciously. "Signori," said he softly but with a fierce intensity, "is it the part of a high-bred signori to fight over my sister? By the toenails of Satan, for the toss of a coin, I will call you both out. You, Marcita, go to your chamber, instantly, nor leave until I give you permission." And she went, for independent though she was, none cared to face the slim, effeminate-appearing youth when a tigerish snarl curled his lips, a murderous gleam lightened his dark eyes. Apologies were made, but from the glances the two rivals threw at each other, we knew that the quarrel was not forgotten, and would blaze forth again at the slightest pretext. Late that night, I woke suddenly, with a strange, eerie feeling of horror. Why, I could not say. I rose, saw that the door was firmly bolted, and seeing Gola asleep on the floor, kicked him awake irritably. And just as he got up, hastily rubbing himself, the silence was broken by a wild scream, a scream that rang through the castle and brought a startled shout from the arquebusier. Pacing the palisade, a scream from the mouth of a girl frenzied with terror. Gola squawked and dived behind the divan. I jerked the door open and raced down the dark corridor, dashing down a winding stair. I caromed into someone at the bottom and we tumbled headlong. He gasped something and I recognized the voice of Jean de Smart. I hauled him to his feet and raced along, he following. The screams had ceased, but the whole castle was in an uproar. Voices shouting, the clank of weapons, lights flashing up. Don Vicente's voice shouting for the soldiers, the noise of armed men rushing through the rooms and falling over each other. With all the confusion, the Smart, the Spaniard, and I reached Marcita's room just as Luigi darted inside and snatched his sister into his arms. Others rushed in, carrying lights and weapons, shouting, demanding to know what was occurring. The girl lay quietly in her brother's arms, her dark hair loose and rippling over his shoulders, her dainty night garments torn to shreds and exposing her lovely body. Long scratches showed upon her arms, breast, and shoulders. Presently she opened her eyes, shuddered, then shrieked wildly, and clung frantically to Luigi, begging him not to let something take her. "The door," she whimpered. "I left it unbarred, and something crept into my room through the darkness. I struck at it with my dagger, and it hurled me to the floor, tearing at me. Then I fainted." "Where is von Schiller?" asked the Spaniard, a fierce glint in his dark eyes. Every man glanced at his neighbor. All the guests were there except the German. I noted de Montour, gazing at the terrified girl, his face more haggard than usual, and I thought it strange that he wore no weapon. "Aye, von Schiller," exclaimed de Smart fiercely, and half of us followed Don Vicente out into the corridor. We began a vengeful search through the castle. In a small, dark hallway, we found von Schiller. On his face he lay, in a crimson, ever-widening stain. "This is the work of some fiend," exclaimed the Smart. face aghast. "Nonsense," bellowed Don Vicente. "No one from here, from the outside, could pass the soldiers. All the servants, von Schiller's among them, were barred and bolted in the servants' quarters, except Gola, who sleeps in Pierre's room, and Isabel's woman." "But who else could have done this deed?" exclaimed the smart in a fury. "You," I said abruptly. "Else, why ran you so swiftly away from the room of Marcita?" "Curse you! You lie!" he shouted, and a swift-drawn sword leaped from my breast, but quick as he was, the Spaniard was quicker. The smart's rapiers clattered against the wall, and the smart stood like a statue, the Spaniard's motionless point just touching his throat. "Bind him," said the Spaniard, without passion. "Put down your blade, Don Florenzo," commanded Don Vicente, striding forward and dominating the scene. "Signor de Smart, you are one of my best friends, but I am the only law here, and duty must be done. Give your word that you will not seek to escape." "I give it," replied the Gascon calmly. "I acted hastily. I apologize. I was not intentionally running away, but the halls and quarters of this cursed castle confuse me." Of us all, probably, but one man believed them. "Messieurs," the Montour stepped forward, "this youth is not guilty. Turn the German over." Two soldiers did as he asked. The Montour shuddered, pointing the rest of us glanced once, then recoiled in horror. "Could man have done that thing?" "With a dagger," began someone. "No dagger makes wounds like that," said the Spaniard. "The German was torn to pieces by the talons of some frightful beast." We glanced about us, half expecting some hideous monster to leap upon us from the shadows. We searched that castle, every foot, every inch of it, and we found no trace of any beast. Dawn was breaking when I returned to my room, to find that Gola had barred himself in, and it took me nearly a half hour to convince him to let me in. Having smacked him soundly and berated him for his cowardice, I told him what had taken place, as he could understand French, and could speak a weird mixture which he proudly called French. His mouth gaped, and only the whites of his eyes showed as the tale reached its climax. "Juju," he whispered fearsomely, "fetish man." Suddenly an idea came to me. I had heard vague tales, little more than hints of legends, of the devilish leopard cult that existed on the west coast. No white man had ever seen one of its votaries, but Don Vicente had told us tales of beast men, disguised in skins of leopards, who stole through the midnight jungle and slew and devoured. A ghastly thrill traveled up and down my spine, and an instant I had Gola in a grasp, which made him yell. "Was that a leopard man?" I hissed, shaking him viciously. "No, no," he gasped. "No, Juju man get. No. You'll tell me?" I gritted, renewing my endeavors, until his hands, waving feeble protest, he promised to tell me what he knew. "No leopard man," he whispered, and his eyes grew big with supernatural fear. "Moon. He fool. Woodcutter find. Him heap clawed. Find another woodcutter. Don Vicente say, leopard. No leopard. But leopard man. He come to kill. Something kill leopard man." Ah, the full moon again. Something come in lonely hut. And claw. A woman. Don Vicente say leopard. Full moon again. And woodcutter fine. He clawed. Now come in castle. No leopard. But always footmarks of a man. I gave a startled, incredulous exclamation. It was true, Gola averred, always the footprints of a man led away from the scene of the murder. Then why did the natives not tell Don Vicente that he might hunt down the fiend? Here Gola assumed a crafty expression and whispered in my ear. The footprints were of a man who wore shoes. Even assuming that Gola was lying, I felt a thrill of unexplainable horror. Who then did the natives believe was doing these frightful murders? And he answered, Don Vicente. By this time, messieurs, my mind was in a whirl. What was the meaning of all this? Who slew the German and sought to ravish Marcita? And as I reviewed the crime, it appeared to me that murder rather than rape was the object of the attack. Why did the Montour warn us and then appear to have knowledge of the crime, telling us that the Smart was innocent and then proving it? It was all beyond me. The tale of the slaughter got among the natives in spite of all we could do, and they appeared restless and nervous, and thrice that day Don Vicente had to go ahead and calm them down. A brooding atmosphere pervaded the castle. and all the servants felt it. I considered going to Don Vicente with Gola's tale, but decided to wait a while. The women kept their chambers that day. The men were restless and moody. Don Vicente announced that the sentries would be doubled, and some would patrol the quarters of the castle itself. I found myself musing cynically that if Gola's suspicions were true, sentries would be of little good. I am not, messieurs, a man to brook such a situation with patience, and I was young then. So, as we drank before retiring, I flung my goblet on the table, and angrily announced that in spite of man, beast, or devil, I slept that night with doors flung wide, and I tramped angrily to my chamber. Again, as on the first night, the Montour came, and his face was as a man who had looked into the gaping gates of hell. "I have come," he said, "to ask you, nay, monsieur, to implore you to reconsider your rash determination." I shook my head impatiently. "You are resolved, yes? Then I ask you to do this for me, that after I enter my chamber, you will bolt my doors from the outside." I did as he asked, and then made my way back to my chamber, my mind in a maze of wonderment. I had sent Gola to the servants' quarters, and I laid rapier and dagger close at hand. Nor did I go to bed, but crouched in a great chair in the darkness. Then I had much to do to keep from sleeping. To keep myself awake, I fell to musing on the strange words of de Montour. He seemed to be laboring under a great excitement. His eyes hinted of ghastly mysteries known to him alone, and yet his face was not that of a wicked man. Suddenly the notion took me to go to his chamber and talk with him. Walking those dark passages was a shuddersome task, but eventually I stood before de Montour's door. I called softly. Silence. I reached out a hand and felt splintered fragments of wood. Hastily I struck flint and steel which I carried, and the flaming tinder showed the great oaken door, sagging on its mighty hinges, showed a door smashed and splintered from the inside, and the chamber of de Montour was unoccupied. Some instinct prompted me to hurry back to my room swiftly but silently, shoeless feet treading softly, and as I neared the door I was aware of something in the darkness before me, something which crept in from a side corridor and glided stealthily along. In a wild panic of fear, I leaped, striking wildly and aimlessly in the darkness. My clenched fist encountered a human head, and something went down with a crash. Again I struck a light. A man lay senseless on the floor, and he was de Montour. I thrust a candle into a niche in the wall, and just then de Montour's eyes opened, and he rose uncertainly. "You!" I exclaimed, hardly knowing what I said. "You, of all men?" He merely nodded. "You killed von Schiller?" "Yes." I recoiled with a gasp of horror. "Listen," he raised his hand. "Take your rapier and run me through. No man will touch you." "No," I exclaimed, "I cannot." "Then quick," he said hurriedly, "get into your chamber and bolt the door. Haste. It will return." "What will return?" I asked with a thrill of horror. "If it will harm me, it will harm you. Come into the chamber with me." "No, no," he fairly shrieked, springing back from my outstretched arm. "Haste, haste. It left me for an instant, but it will return." In a low-pitched voice of indescribable horror, "It is returning. It is here now." And I felt a something, a formless, shapeless presence near, a thing of frightfulness. De Montour was standing, legs braced, arms thrown back, fists clenched. The muscles bulged beneath his eyes widened and narrowed. The veins stood out upon his forehead as if in great physical effort. As I looked, to my horror, out of nothing, a shapeless, nameless something took vague form. Like a shadow it moved upon de Montour. It was hovering about him. Good God, it was merging, becoming one with the man. De Montour swayed. A great gasp escaped him. The dim thing vanished. De Montour wavered. Then he turned toward me, and may God grant that I never look on a face like that again. It was a hideous, a bestial face. The eyes gleamed with a frightful ferocity. The snarling lips were drawn back from gleaming teeth, which to my startled gaze appeared more like bestial fangs than human teeth. Silently the thing, I cannot call it a human, slunk toward me. Gasping with horror, I sprang back and through the door, just as the thing launched itself through the air with a sinuous motion which even then made me think of a leaping wolf. I slammed the door, holding it against a frightful thing which hurled itself again and again against it. Finally it desisted, and I heard it slink stealthily off down the corridor. Faint and exhausted, I sat down, waiting, listening. Through the open window wafted a breeze, bearing all the scents of Africa, the spicy and the foul. From the village came the sound of a native drum. Other drums answered further up the river and back in the bush. Then from somewhere in the jungle, horribly incongruous, sounded the long, high-pitched call of a timber wolf. My soul revolted. Dawn brought a tale of terrified villagers, of a woman torn by some fiend of the night, barely escaping. And to the Montour I went. On the way I met Don Vicente. He was perplexed and angry. "Some hellish thing is at work in this castle," he said. "Last night, though I have said naught of it to anyone, something leaped upon the back of one of the arquebusiers, tore the leather jerkin from his shoulder, and pursued him to the barbican. More, someone knocked the Montour into his room last night, and he was forced to smash the door to get out." He strode on, muttering to himself, and I proceeded down the stairs, more puzzled than ever. The Montour sat upon a stool, gazing out the window. An indescribable air weariness was about him. His long hair was uncombed and tousled. His garments were tattered. With a shudder I saw faint crimson stains upon his hands, and noted that the nails were torn and broken. He looked up as I came in, and waved me to a seat. His face was worn and haggard, but was that of a man. After a moment's silence he spoke. "I will tell you my strange tale. Never before has it passed my lips. And why I tell you, knowing that you will not believe me, I cannot say." And then I listened to what was surely the wildest, the most fantastic, the weirdest tale ever heard by man. "Years ago," said the Montour, "I was upon a military mission in northern France. Alone, I was forced to pass through the fiend-haunted woodlands of Villefer. In those frightful forests I was beset by an inhuman, a ghastly thing, a werewolf. Beneath a midnight moon we fought, and I slew it. Now this is the truth, that if a werewolf is slain in the half-form of a man, its ghost will haunt its slayer through eternity. But if it is slain as a wolf, hell gapes to receive it. The true werewolf is not, as many think, a man who may take the form of a wolf, but a wolf who takes the form of a man. Now listen, my friend, and I will tell you of the wisdom, the hellish knowledge that is mine, gained through many a frightful deed, imparted to me amid the ghastly shadows of midnight forest, where fiends and half-beasts roamed. In the beginning the world was strange, misshapen. Grotesque beasts wandered through its jungles. Driven from another world, ancient demons and fiends came in great numbers and settled upon this newer, younger world. Long the forces of good and evil warred. A strange beast, known as man, wandered among the other beasts, and since good or bad must have a concrete form, ere either accomplishes its desires. The spirits of good entered man. The fiends entered other beasts, reptiles and birds, and long and fiercely waged the age-old battle. But man conquered. The great dragons and serpents were slain, and with them the demons. Finally Solomon, wise beyond the ken of man, made great war upon them, and by virtue of his wisdom slew, seized, and bound. But there were some which were the fiercest, the boldest, and though Solomon drove them out, he could not conquer them. Those had taken the form of wolves. As the ages passed, wolf and demon became merged. No longer could the fiend leave the body of the wolf at will. In many instances the savagery of the wolf overcame the subtlety of the demon and enslaved him. So the wolf became again only a beast, a fierce, cunning beast, but merely a beast. But of the werewolves, there are many, even yet. And during the time of the full moon, the wolf may take the form, or the half-form, of a man. When the moon hovers at her zenith, however, the wolf spirit again takes ascendancy, and the werewolf becomes a true wolf once more. But if it is slain in the form of a man, then the spirit is free to haunt its lair through the ages. Hearken now. I thought to have slain the thing after it had changed to its true shape, but I slew it in an instant too soon. The moon, though it approached the zenith, had not yet reached it, nor had the thing taken on fully the wolf form. Of this I knew nothing, and went my way. But when the next time approached for the full moon, I began to be aware of a strange, malicious influence. An atmosphere of horror hovered in the air, and I was aware of inexplicable, uncanny impulses. One night, in a small village in the center of a great forest, the influence came upon me with full power. It was night, and the moon, nearly full, was rising over the forest, and between the moon and me I saw floating in the upper air, ghostly and barely discernible, the outline of a wolf's head. I remember little of what happened thereafter. I remember dimly clambering into the silent street, remembering struggling, resisting briefly, vainly, and the rest is a crimson maze until I came to myself the next morning and found my garments and hands caked and stained crimson, and heard the horrified chattering of the villagers telling of a pair of clandestine lovers slaughtered in a ghastly manner scarcely outside the village, torn to pieces as if by wild beasts, as if by wolves. From that village I fled aghast, but I fled not alone. In the day I could not feel the drive of my fearful captor, but when night fell and the moon rose, I ranged the silent forest, a frightful thing, a slayer of humans, a fiend in a man's body. God, the battles I have fought, but always it overcame me and drove me ravening after some new victim. But after the moon had passed its fullness, the thing's power over me ceased suddenly, nor did it return until 3 nights before the moon was full again. Since then I have roamed the world, fleeing, seeking to escape. Always the thing follows, taking possession of my body when the moon is full. Gods, the frightful deeds I have done. I would have slain myself long ago, but I dare not, for the soul of a suicide is accursed, and my soul will be forever hunted through the flames of hell. And hearken, most frightful of all, my slain body would forever roam the earth, moved and inhabited by the soul of the werewolf. Can any thought be more ghastly? And I seem immune to the weapons of man. Swords have pierced me, daggers have hacked me. I am covered with scars, yet never have they struck me down. In Germany they bound and led me to the block. There would I willingly place my head, but the thing came upon me, and breaking my bonds, I slew and fled. Up and down the world I have wandered, leaving horror and slaughter in my trails. Chains, cells, cannot hold me. The thing is fastened to me through all eternity. In desperation, I accepted Don Vicente's invitation, for look you, none knows of my frightful double life, since no one could recognize me in the clutch of the demon, and few, seeing me, live to tell of it. My hands are red, my soul doomed to everlasting flames. My mind is torn with remorse for my crimes, and yet I can do nothing to help myself. Surely, Pierre, no man ever knew the hell that I have known. Yes, I slew von Schiller, and I sought to destroy the girl, Marcito. Why did that I cannot say, for I have slain both women and men. Now, if you will, take your sword and slay me, and with my last breath I will give you the good God's blessing, no? You know now my tale, and you see before you a man fiend-haunted for all eternity. My mind was spinning with wonderment as I left the room of de Montour. What to do I knew not. It seemed likely that he would yet murder us all, and yet I could not bring myself to tell Don Vicente at all. From the bottom of my soul I pitied de Montour. So I kept my peace, and in the days that followed I made occasion to seek him out and converse with him. A real friendship sprang up between us. About this time my servant Gola began to wear an air of suppressed excitement, as if he knew something he wished desperately to tell, but would not, or else dared not. So the days passed in feasting, drinking, and hunting, until one night de Montour came to my chamber and pointed silently at the moon, which was just rising. "Look ye," he said, "I have a plan. I will give it out that I am going into the jungle for hunting, and will go forth, apparently, for several days. But at night I will return to the castle, and you must lock me into the dungeon which is used as a storeroom." This we did, and I managed to slip down twice a day and carry food and drink to my friend. He insisted on remaining in the dungeon even in the day, for though the fiend had never exerted its influence over him in the daytime, and he believed it powerless then, yet he would take no chances. It was during this time that I began to notice that Don Vicente's mink-faced cousin Carlos was forcing his attentions upon Isabel, who was his second cousin and who seemed to resent those attentions. Myself, I would have challenged him for a duel for the toss of a coin, for I despised him, but it was really none of my affair. However, it seemed that Isabel feared him. My friend Luigi, by the way, had become enamored of the dainty Portuguese girl and was making swift love to her daily, and the Montour sat in his cell and reviewed his ghastly deeds until he battered the bars with his bare hands, and Don Florenzo wandered about the castle grounds like a dour Mephistopheles, and the other guests rode and quarreled and drank. And Gola slithered about, eyeing me as if always on the point of imparting momentous information. What wonder if my nerves became rasped to the shrieking point? Each day the villagers grew surlier and more sullen and intractable. One night, not long before the full of the moon, I entered the dungeon where De Montour sat. He looked up quickly. "You dare much, coming to me in the night?" I shrugged my shoulders, seating myself. A small barred window let in the night scents and sounds of Africa. "Hark to the native drums," I said. "For the past week, they have sounded almost incessantly." De Montour assented. "The villagers are restless. Methinks 'tis deviltry they are planning. Have you noticed that Carlos is much among them?" "No," I answered, "but 'tis like there will be a break between him and Luigi. Luigi is paying court to Isabel." So we talked, when suddenly De Montour became silent and moody, answering only in monosyllables. The moon rose and peered in at the barred windows. De Montour's face was illuminated by its beams, and then the hand of horror grasped me. On the wall behind De Montour appeared a shadow clearly defined of a wolf's head. At the same instant, De Montour felt its influence. With a shriek, he bounded from his stool. He pointed fiercely, and as with trembling hands I slammed and bolted the door behind me, I felt him hurl his weight against it. As I fled up the stairway, I heard a wild raving and battering at the iron-bound door, but with all the werewolf's might, the great door held. As I entered my room, Gola dashed in and gasped out the tale he had been keeping for days. I listened incredulously and then dashed forth to find Don Vicente. I was told that Carlos had asked him to accompany him to the village to arrange a trade. My informer was Don Florenzo of Seville, and when I gave him a brief outline of Gola's tale, he accompanied me. Together we dashed to the castle gate, flinging a word to the guards, and down the landing towards the village. Don Vicente, walk with care, keep sword loosened in his sheath. Fool, to walk in the night with Carlos, the traitor. They were nearing the village when we caught up with them. Don Vicente, I exclaimed. Return instantly to the castle. Carlos is selling you into the hands of the villagers. Gola has told me that he lusts for your wealth and for Isabel. A terrified native babbled him of booted footprints near the places where the woodcutters were murdered, and Carlos has made them believe that the slayer was you. Tonight, the villagers were to rise and slay every man in the castle except Carlos. Do you not believe me, Don Vicente? Is this truth, Carlos? Asked Don Vicente in amazement. Carlos laughed mockingly. The fool speaks truth, he said, but it accomplishes you nothing. He shouted and he leaped for Don Vicente. Steel flashed in the moonlight, and the Spaniard's sword was through Carlos ere he could move, and the shadows rose about us. Then it was back to back, sword and dagger, three men against 100. Spears flashed, and a fiendish yell went up from the savage throats. I spitted three in my many thrusts, and then went down from a stunning swing from a war club. An instant later, Don Vicente fell upon me, with a spear in one arm and another through the leg. Don Florenzo was standing above, his sword leaping like a living thing, when a charge of the arquebusiers swept the river bank clear, and we were borne into the castle. The hordes came with a rush, spears flashing like a wave of steel, a thunderous roar of savagery going up to the skies. Time and again they swept up the slopes, bounding the moat, until they were swarming over the palisades, and again the fire of the 100-odd defenders hurled them back. They set fire to the plundered warehouses, and their light vied with the light of the moon. Just across the river there was a larger storehouse, and about this hordes of them gathered, tearing it apart for plunder. Would that they would drop torch upon us, said Don Vicente, for naught is stored therein, save some 1,000 pounds of gunpowder. I dare not store the treacherous stuff this side of the river. All the tribes of the river and coast have gathered for our slaughter, and all my ships are upon the seas. We may hold out a while, but eventually they will swarm the palisade and put us to the slaughter. I hastened to the dungeon, where De Montour sat. Outside the door I called to him, and he bade me enter in a voice which told me the fiend had left him for an instant. The villagers have risen, I told him. I guessed as much. How goes the battle? I gave him the details of the betrayal and the fight, and mentioned the powder house across the river. He sprang to his feet. Now, by my hag-ridden soul, he exclaimed, I will fling the dice once more with hell. Swift, let me out of the castle. I will essay to swim the river and set off yon powder. It is insanity, I exclaimed. 1,000 men lurk between the palisades and the river, and thrice that number beyond. The river itself swarms with crocodiles. I will attempt it, he answered, a great light in his face. If I can reach it, some of them will lighten the siege. If I am slain, then my soul is free, and mayhap will gain some forgiveness for that I gave my life to atone for my crimes. Then Haste, he exclaimed, for the demon is returning. Already I fear his influence. Haste ye! For the castle gates we sped. And as the Montour ran, he gasped as a man in a terrific battle. At the gate he pitched headlong, then rose to spring through it. Wild yells greeted him from the natives. The arquebusier shouted curses at him and me. Peering down from the top of the palisades, I saw him turn from side to side, uncertainly. A score of villagers were rushing recklessly forward, spears raised. Then the eerie wolf yell rose to the skies, and the Montour bounded forward. Aghast, the natives paused, and before a man of them could move, he was among them. Wild shrieks, not of rage, but of terror. In amazement, the arquebusiers held their fire. Straight through the group of men the Montour charged, and when they broke and fled, three of them fled not. A dozen steps the Montour took in pursuit, then stopped, stock still. A moment he stood so, while spears flew about him, then turned and ran swiftly in the direction of the river. A few steps from the river, another band of villagers barred his way. In the flaming light of the burning house, the scene was clearly illuminated. A thrown spear tore through the Montour's shoulder. Without pausing in his stride, he tore it forth and drove it through a native, leaping over his body to get among the others. They could not face the fiend-driven man. With shrieks they fled, and the Montour, bounding upon the back of one, brought him down. Then he rose, staggered, and sprang to the river bank. An instant he paused there and then vanished in the shadows. "Name of the devil," gasped Don Vicente at my shoulder. "What manner of man is that? Was that the Montour?" I nodded. The wild yells of the men rose above the crackle of the arbacus fire. They were massed thick about the great warehouse across the river. "They plan a great rush," said Don Vicente. "They will swarm clear over the palisade, methinks." A crash that seemed to rip the skies apart. A burst of flame that mounted to the stars. The castle rocked with the explosion, then silence, as the smoke drifting away showed only a great crater where the warehouse had stood. I could tell of how Don Vicente led a charge, crippled as he was, out of the castle gate and down the slope to fall upon the terrified villagers who'd escaped the explosion. I could tell of the slaughter, of the victory in the pursuit of those that fled. I could tell, too, messieurs, of how I became separated from the band and of how I wandered far into the jungle, unable to find my way back to the coast. I could tell I was captured by a wandering band of raiders and of how I escaped. But such is not my intention. In itself, it would make a long tale. And it is of the Montour that I am speaking. I thought much of the things that had passed, and wondered if indeed the Montour reached the storehouse to blow it to the skies, or whether it was but the deed of chance. That a man could swim that reptile-swarming river, fiend-driven though he was, seemed impossible. And if he blew up the storehouse, he must have gone up with it. So one night, I pushed my way wearily through the jungle and sighted down the coast, and close to the shore a small tumble-down hut of thatch. To it I went, thinking to sleep therein if insects and reptiles would allow. I entered the doorway and then stopped short. Upon a makeshift stool sat a man. He looked up as I entered, and the rays of the moon fell upon his face. I started back with a ghastly thrill of horror. It was the Montour, and the moon was full. Then, as I stood unable to flee, he rose and came toward me, and his face, though haggard, as of a man who has looked into hell, was the face of a sane man. "Come in, my friend," he said, and there was a great peace in his voice. "Come in and fear me not. The fiend has left me forever." "But tell me, how conquered you?" I exclaimed as I grasped his hand. "I fought a frightful battle as I ran to the river," he answered, "for the fiend had me in its grasp and drove me to fall upon the villagers. But for the first time, my soul and mind gained ascendancy for an instant just long enough to hold me to my purpose, and I believe the good saints came to my aid, for I was giving my life to save life. I leaped into the river and swam, and in an instant the crocodiles were swarming about me. Again in the clutch of the fiend I fought them, there in the river. Then suddenly the thing left me. I climbed from the river and fired the warehouse. The explosion hurled me hundreds of feet, and for days I wandered witless through the jungle. But the full moon came, and came again, and I felt not the influence of the fiend. I am free, free!" And a wondrous note of exultation, nay, exaltation, thrilled his words. "My soul is free. Incredible as it seems, the demon lies drowned upon the bed of the river, or else inhabits the body of one of the savage reptiles that swim the ways of the Niger."